This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. This is episode 144 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max.
Hi, David. How are you?
Good. I'm looking forward to everyone hearing my interviews from Langley. They were incredibly accommodated, and we talked about a lot of cool stuff, especially even autonomy and artificial intelligence, which was with Dr. Allen, and it turned out to be a wonderful interview, nice, relaxing, and I'm glad I over-prepped for it because it was really wonderful, and we got a new fan, and she's looking to have us back for some testing. Langley is a very large campus. There's 140 buildings, and NASA is about to launch a new test using those buildings as an urban environment for delivery. Autonomy. So the scenario we were talking about was FedEx brings a package to the front gate, and right now they have to be swept for bombs and explosives and stuff. Instead, they're going to load the package up on a UAV and fly it to one of the buildings autonomously, so it will learn to navigate around the buildings and avoid people. And it's kind of Jetson-y, but it was a really neat concept. So I'm looking forward to getting those worked up and our audience hearing how far ahead NASA is on autonomy and drone delivery and other good stuff. So it was really good conversations.
Sounds very, very exciting, David. Can't wait to be able to present that to all of our listeners.
So we got a lot to talk about. We've got UTM successes for NASA and the FAA. Do you have a drone brain or a brain for drone racing? Instead of night moves, we've got night drones. Last chance to comment on the small UAS rules and another interview from the Drone Dealer Expo brought to you by Tim Trott. So I guess we got a full show, so let's get started. Our first story is NASA, the FAA test sites conduct largest drone management test. NASA marks success for the most complex drone traffic management test yet at the FAA test sites. And this is about UTM, or air traffic control and drone management, or UAS traffic management. So pretty neat. A lot of drones flying all at one time, huh, Max?
Well, not only that, but they're flying in different locations. This was a three-hour field test, and it occurred across all six FAA UAS test sites. They had 24 drones in total, and they were operated under this UTM research platform, UAS Traffic Management Research Platform. And as many as 22 drones flew simultaneously at one point during this exercise. So it was kind of a major milestone in the process of bringing UTM to reality.
And, I mean, we're tracking multiple states, multiple targets. It's a lot more in-depth. It sounds kind of simple on the top part. Oh, well, it's just doing air traffic control for UAVs. But the scope of this is a really big step. We're talking about multiple levels, multiple types of drones, big ones, small ones, fat ones, little ones. The UTM researcher platform checked for conflicts, approved or rejected the flight plans, and notified the users of constraints, and all the while monitored weather conditions on the various sites.
Yeah, this was a pretty impressive demonstration. It is just the first step, as we said. This was the first level, first of four levels that this platform is going to progress through before it becomes something that NASA intends to ultimately turn over to the FAA. That to be in 2019. So we're still a few years away. But again, this is great progress, an important area. It's a step-by-step process, David. I mean, you'd like to go from, you know, no air traffic control or traffic management for UAS to a fully functional traffic management system, but it's just not realistic to expect that. So again, here we've accomplished the first level of testing, and the demonstration seems to have gone very well. So that's very, very encouraging.
And they're all take those lessons and move it to the next step. So we're really happy. Ames is doing really good work on this UTM, and I think it's moving at a fairly steady pace too. They're making their milestones, and there's a continuous improvement. We're not doing quantum leaps, but definitely we'll look forward to the next attempt and the next phase two of this, which I think is occurring later this year or early next year, which would be 2017.
Great.
So the next one, we've talked a lot about drone racing and first-person view, but how about first brain view? thinking your way through the course. This was from TechCrunch.com. University of Florida held world's first brain-controlled drone race. 16 pilots at the University of Florida used a brain-computer interface, a BCI, to control a DJI Phantoms down a 10-yard course, showing brain power.
Yeah, sure. It's very fascinating. There's a video associated with this TechCrunch article that you might want to take a look at. When they call it drone racing, you know, that might be kind of an exaggeration, just, you know, very simply getting these Phantoms to progress down this course purely on brain power was an accomplishment.
Quite a challenge.
Quite a challenge. And the way they did that is the pilots initially donned electroencephalogram headsets. And then they had these pilots or subjects maybe think about things like pushing forward, like the way you would push a control stick forward. And then they measured the neuron activity associated with each of those individual people. And then they used that as a way to operate the controllers during this race. What you see are a group of pilots sitting behind tables. I think usually they had their eyes closed, and you could see the expression on their faces as they were sort of trying to will these Phantoms forward. But it actually worked. This is a technology that I think is being used in other areas. I think people with prosthetic limbs and so forth have undergone studies where they can control the operation of those prosthetics just by thinking about the movements. And so here we see that technology apply to unmanned vehicles in a very interesting way.
So this is, to quote Caddyshack, this is be the drone. You are the drone. Be the drone. Na 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 na.
That's it. Yeah.
This is... It seems so sci-fi tech, but watching them do it, it's really cool. And definitely go out and look at the TechCrunch video. We'll call that the video of the week. You need to go look at that and watch these people think their way through the problem. It's coming, so that's the next step. This makes first-person view seem like, next thing you know, they'll be feeding back to the brain, so...
There's something else that's coming, David, flying at night.
Yeah. This is from Shepherd Media. Tremco Roofing and Building Maintenance has been granted approval by the FAA to conduct UAV operations at night. They're the first commercial drone operator to be granted this approval to inspect buildings at night, energy leaks, rooftop damages, deteriorating facades, safety issues, etc. So if you want to detect heat leaks and where heat's leaking from a building, the best time to do it would be night, because that's when the infrared will work the best. So it's interesting. They're working with Skyworks in Toronto, and they've created Skybeam, which is the building envelope aerial mapping UAV. So the FAA is giving them authorization to fly at night with their 333 exemption. So it's interesting. I wonder what their workup was to convince the FAA to allow them, because up till now, flying at night has been a no-no.
Yeah. Now, the application here is at construction sites. So that might have factored into the FAA's agreeing to allow this, because I can imagine, David, that it's kind of a controlled environment, these construction sites. One of the interesting things is that the article points out that the inspection job with a drone can be done in about one hour, and that under normal circumstances with a manned team, it would take 10 hours to perform these types of inspections as they're constructing buildings. So to reduce from 10 hours worth of work by a team to 1 hour of work by what I would imagine to be a much smaller team is a significant improvement, and obviously something that those in the construction business would be very interested in exploring. But this uses an Arion Skyranger quadcopter. It allows these images and the video to be stitched together into a virtual 2D or even a 3D model, which aids in the analysis and pinpointing of the issues. And that, of course, leading to any corrective action that needs to be taken by the construction company the next day after everyone wakes up, I guess, David, and there's sunlight again.
It is a dramatic difference in the amount of time it takes for the quad to do this. You know, 1 man hour versus 10 man hours is kind of will be upsetting to current presidential candidates, because that means a loss of night hours worth of man hour jobs. This will be a scandal as far as our political contests go, but it is really a really wonderful use of a UAV. It's another one of those positive things. And to create a 3D model after an hour and really pinpoint and focus your work, you're probably not only, besides saving 9 hours on the actual collecting the data, you're probably saving hours on the fixing the problem, because you've got a more detailed analysis of where the problem is that you can target to fix. All of this can be added in real time to a tablet. So real quick data turnaround, real quick fixes, good for them. And we'll see if this opens up the floodgates for other night flights. I mean, like night photography. We'll see. 333 is still coming through. Can't go a week without a new 333 allowing somebody to do something new. So good for the FAA.
And speaking of the FAA, we see that there's some news on the small UAS front.
This is from our friends at Hogan Lovells. The FAA has sent a small UAS NPRM to the White House for a final interagency review. Operation and certification of small unmanned aircraft systems rule must go through the process of at the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA, at the White House. Now, we know that Lisa from Hogan Lovells used to work in this department, and basically, they are going to, again, put things up for comments for people to give their opinions on the rulemaking. We've done it through the RPM, but this is a final lap, I guess, for the White House to put their stamp of approval on it before it becomes law.
Yeah, the OIRA has sometimes been called the most powerful agency in Washington that nobody has ever heard of. And this is the organization that regulations have to pass through before they can be implemented. It's a step in the process. The OIRA received the FAA's small UAS rule on April 20th, 2016. And the review period can, it can take varying amounts of time depending on the situation. I think there's an executive order that says that they have to do that within 90 days. But sometimes we see extensions to that are granted. But Hogan Lovells in their post notes that the average review period for the OIRA is 53 days. So that would suggest that, as a number of people have predicted, that we may see this rule, this regulation, come into effect sometime this summer. Of course, I guess that depends on the result of the OIRA review. If there are some kinds of problems or issues that come up, I guess that it could go back to the FAA for some rework. So short of that, hopefully we'll see some rulemaking in the not-too-distant future. But the point that David makes is the most important one, which is that any member of the public can actually request a meeting with the OIRA to discuss a proposed rule. So if you, your company, your organization, your firm, whatever, has some issues with the small UAS rule that the FAA is proposing, this is your last opportunity to speak up and let your voice be heard.
So go out there. We'll put links to the show notes on how you can get a hold of them, and this is your last chance. And the worst that'll happen is it'll get sent back to the FAA. But let's hope it sort of goes smoothly, and maybe we get this chapter of regulation put behind us and we can move forward. So with that, I think we're going to take a breather and go back to one of Tim Trott's interviews from the Drone Dealer Expo.
This is with Lance Knowles. He's with Drone Nerds Incorporated. And they talk about a number of interesting things. They talk about the impact of regulations. They talk about the responsibilities of manufacturers and dealers. And Lance has an interesting position on that. They also talk about knowledge exams and check rides for drone operators and some other topics as well. So let's listen to Tim Trott speaking with Lance Knowles of Drone Nerds.
Drone Nerds is a distributor, and we carry a wide range of drone technology from all sorts of different manufacturers.
Can you like outline some of the products that you have?
Sure. We've got a whole slew of DJI products. Their newly released one, the Phantom 4, which has object avoidance in it. We've also got a more professional setup, which is the DJI Inspire, and that carries a Micro Four Thirds camera. Then we've got a real heavy lift professional system called Monster X, and that carries much larger setups up to about 20 pounds in payload.
That would be more applicable for maybe public safety?
For high-end commercial applications, yes. So industrial applications, big productions in cinema, Hollywood world, search and rescue, FLIR, all sorts, anything you can think of. You know, we've got a 75-pound all-up weight capacity, so you can imagine all the different things that you can strap to that drone. There's all sorts of stuff that we distribute. It's not just drones. We've got follow focus systems. We've got gimbals for cameras. It all depends on what you're really looking for.
What do you see as the impact, negative or positive, about the FAA regulations?
I'd say the negative impact on it is definitely the restrictiveness of it. They're very restrictive, the regulations right now, for commercial applications. You can't fly within 500 feet of people. You can't go over crowds. You need the time it takes to actually file to get the approvals. Sometimes you don't have that time. You know, productions call you up up 3-4 days ahead of the shoot, and they want you on set, and they don't realize that, you know, there's a whole sometimes up to 30 to 120 day application process to be able to fly in certain areas. So I would say those are the cons behind that, but I mean the pros are, you know, they're trying to keep it safe, and if everybody out there is flying around for the mighty dollar, a lot of bad things can probably go wrong. So regulation is needed, but I think that the FAA should really consult more with industry professionals to find out what can be done to make the regulations a little more accommodating for the companies.
Recently, the ARC's final report came out, and there were some complaints that it did not really, the input to the process was not really what it should have been so far as who was contributing. Matter of fact, some of the manufacturers basically said, we don't agree with this.
Yeah, well, I can believe that. You know, obviously the manufacturer's job is to sell drones. So any roadblocks that they're going to face along that way is going to be something they're not going to agree with. They want to move product. And if there's regulations in place or restrictions in place that don't allow them to move the product, then yeah, they will be against it.
What are the manufacturers' and the dealers' responsibilities with regard to education?
I would say the responsibility certainly falls on the manufacturer for educating people on how to properly use the drone. The dealers, they can offer, you know, training courses, stuff like that, etc. But ultimately, they shouldn't be held responsible for what the end user does with it. Manufacturers should be held responsible for putting in certain safety features, such as geofencing near airports or sensitive areas, so that the drone is not allowed to enter those areas. Maybe the height restrictions, obviously. The way these drones come right now, most of them are out of the box capable of excess of 1,500 feet altitude. I would say immediately that should not even be an option. If you buy a drone, it should be limited to 400 feet. Above 400 feet, you're starting to get into risky airspace. So I think some of the responsibility should definitely fall on the manufacturer as far as keeping the skies safe. The dealer, like I said, should just offer courses and training and make the client understand and aware of the dangers that UAVs do pose in national airspace. But beyond that, all of the responsibility is on the user, the end user. They're the person that's flying it. They're the ones who make the decision or the bad decision.
A lot of the legislation is talking about requiring an online written test. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I'm totally for that. A knowledge exam is something that would be a lot easier. As of now, if you want to operate commercially, you have to hold, at the minimum, a sport pilot license rating. So that's pretty restrictive for, you know, the average person that wants to go out there and you start using these commercially. They've got to go spend a lot more money to get certification as a pilot. So having a knowledge-based test and maybe just a practical similar to your driving exam, you know, you do a computer-based test and then you actually go out and do a flight and you have to run a certain pattern or something and prove your ability to be able to control it to an instructor before you pass. I believe that Canada has that in place where it's an actual knowledge-based and a practical-based test versus having to hold a pilot's license.
The logical thing would be for the FAA to do the online test like they do for everything else and then have your checkout and whatnot with a regular flight instructor at a flying school.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, definitely. You know, you do a knowledge-based exam, and then you do a check ride, you know, and you have a certified UAV instructor, because let's face it, I don't care how many pilot's licenses or commercial rating that you have, you still don't have experience flying a UAV. So, yeah, you're going to have a highly trained UAV individual out there that understands how the systems work, that can look at the platform that you intend to fly and deem it airworthy, and deem your piloting also, you know, your skill level at where it should be to be able to operate these things commercially.
Just off the top of your head, how many hours of actual operation do you think that an operator needs before they begin to become proficient?
I would say at least 500 hours. At least 500 hours. You know, you can build 100 hours on these things in a week, but still, that doesn't give you the experience that you need. You know, I'm still learning. I've been flying these for 5 years. I probably got over 1,000 hours log, and I'm still learning the characteristics of these drones. And as the technology changes, obviously, your learning curve is going to change as well.
I was thinking more of, because that becomes an obstacle just as high as the pilot license at that point. Because if somebody has to, you know, go out to the AMA park and fly for 500 hours, I don't know, do the math, how many Saturdays that is, well, and how many batteries that so is. That's four batteries per hour.
Okay, so you got four batteries. And I can tell you, most of these pilots out there, they fly four batteries every time that they're going to go up, and they fly them out quickly. So, you know, you will build your hours rather fast. You know, you got 20 minutes in a flight, you got an hour after a few, and that's not even a day. You know, and they're cycling their batteries, so they're out there flying and flying and flying. So yeah, maybe 500 is a bit up there, but you know, that's, you gotta, yeah, you're gonna want people that have full experience. You know, maybe 100 hours. I know to fly a regular aircraft is only 40 hours. You know, and that's a lot different though. You're up there in the plane the whole time for an hour, sometimes 2 hours. You know, you're hands on with it. With the drones, you know, you may only get 20 and then go home for a week.
It's 20 for the sport pilot.
20 for sport. Yes, for PPL it's 40 hours. So the sport pilot being the minimum rating, yeah, it's 20. But it's for like, this is what I'm saying though. If I'm out there and I'm flying for one day, I get 5 hours. I may not fly again for a month. You know, my skill.
If you own four batteries, you get 1 hour and then you go home. And that means that based on one weekend and 1 hour, that means basically 10 years for your criteria.
If you're only doing one weekend and then...
Well, in practicality, that's the way that a lot of people are.
Yeah, that's the way it all... You know, I don't know. Hour rating is difficult to say. You know, it all depends on experience and conditions that you've flown in and which drones. You know, somebody that's been flying a Phantom their whole life is going to have no idea how to operate something like the Monster. You know, where you're 55 pounds and you're a completely different machine. So this is why I'm saying the hourly rating is kind of difficult to just judge off our hourly rating. So you've got to say, okay, how long have you been flying that craft that you got there?
Well, in regular pilot training, you get hours in type, and it can be like 2, 3, 4, 5 hours, like the Icon A5. If you've got a regular sport pilot license, you do 5 hours on the manual.
I'd love to learn the Icon A5.
Oh, wouldn't we all?
you've got a I'd say rating at what type of drone, or maybe a classification rating. You know, okay, I'm rated for micro UAS, or I'm rated for heavy lift UAS. You know, so, and obviously your hourly rating should then go up from there. So yeah, it could be, obviously, you know, 100 hours may be a little bit too much, excessive for somebody just flying a small quad, but for somebody just trying to get, you know, it could be the same as instrument rated or something like that pilot. You know, the amount of hours increases tremendously. So the same thing is, if you're wanting to fly a system that is a much bigger system, much more complicated setup, higher danger factor, then yes, your rating level should probably have to go up. But this is all something that, you know, we're going to have to approach as it comes through with the FAA and how they decide to start, how they decide to change the regulations a little.
So, David, I think that's interesting and kind of points out some of the difficulties of defining proficiency when it comes to operating a UAS. Do you model it after manned flight proficiency measures, or do you need something else? And again, here we're talking about for commercial operation. That conversation was in that context, not on the, you know, enthusiast or hobbyist kind of context.
Tough call. 500 hours didn't seem unreasonable until you started talking about battery life, and Tim pointed that out, that it's a lot of batteries, and it's tough, because somebody might be really good at 20 hours and somebody might need 300 hours to be the same competent flyer. So interesting discussion, and opens up a lot of possibilities on all sorts of issues.
So we want to thank Tim Trott from Southern Helicom for recording that and some other interviews we have as well that we will be bringing to you. And also thanks to Lance Knowles from Drone Nerds. They're at dronenerds.com for the conversation. All right. Well, David, we received an interesting email today from Molly Livingston about the Flirty drone that we've talked about in the past.
And this was good news, and I'm sure that we will be talking about in a couple of weeks, because we know the one who purchased it, which is Roger Linnaeus of the Smithsonian Institution. It's kind of a small world because I spent last week at NASA Langley Research Center, and I was talking about this here mission specifically, about using the NASA SR-22 to fly out to Western Virginia. Then Flaherty used their hexacopter to deliver medications. That was the first FAA-authorized commercial delivery ever. And that UAV is now going to be part of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum, a place that's near and dear to both of our hearts.
That's right. One thing we know about the National Air and Space Museum is that the aircraft, the displays there are not just examples of interesting pieces of aviation history, but each of them has to have been involved in some specific historic event or situation, and that's what gets it into the museum. And so not just any drone can go into the National Air and Space Museum. It's got to be historically significant. And I think that's really interesting that the Smithsonian has deemed this package delivery by drone as being one of those significant events. So really, congratulations to Flaherty for making it into the Smithsonian.
Yep. And hopefully we'll get Roger when we go to Innovations in Flight, so we can talk a little bit more about why he chose it and why it was considered historical. And we'll have a lot of long discussion about it when we bring up my R. Langley interview. So we're getting it on multiple angles, and it's nice to know that we're being surrounded by something as historic as a drone being entered into the National Air and Space Museum.
And for those of you who don't know, David and I and some of our AvGeek friends attend an annual event at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, specifically at the Udvar-Hazy Center in Dulles, or adjacent to Dulles Airport in Northern Virginia. And this is for the Innovations in Flight Family Day and Aviation Display. It's held the Saturday of Father's Day weekend in June each year. The museum itself is just a fantastic destination that you and your family and your kids especially would just have an amazing time there. But if you can make plans to be there Father's Day weekend in June, not only will you have the opportunity to see all the events occurring that day, but as I mentioned, David and I will be there along with some others, and we'd really look forward to seeing you there and meeting you and saying hello.
And it's not just a museum. If you don't know the Udvar-Hazy Center, it's adjacent to Dulles, but it is connected by a taxiway. And part of Innovations in Flight is a fly-in. So they will have another additional 50 aircraft that just show up for the day in the afternoon, and you can go out and talk to the pilots and meet the people who bring the airplanes there. And like I said, you can come meet Max and I. We'd love to shake hands and talk to you, and we love interacting with our listeners. It's our one chance during the year that we really get a chance to interact as airplane geeks or as UAV geeks. So come out to that. We'll put some information in the show notes, and we'll look forward to seeing you.
And that will be June 18th, 2016, for the Innovations in Flight Day at the Smithsonian.
And you can follow the hashtag InFlight16 on Twitter to find out what's going on there. I'm sure we'll be tweeting out stuff as we lead up to it.
All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to bring this episode to a close. This has been episode 144 of the UAV Digest. As always, you can find us at theuavdigest.com. Show notes for this episode are at theuavdigest.com/144. You'll find links to all of the news stories we talked about, some of the other companies and references as well. So a lot of information there. And then, of course, we're all over social media. David, where do folks find us?
You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. You can become part of our community, which is our Slack team, and that can be found at theuavdigest.com/team. You can become part of our Facebook friends, which is facebook.com/theUAVDigest. Or if you'd like to send us an email, you can send us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com. Or if you want to speak to one of us, it's either max@theuavdigest.com or david@theuavdigest.com. And it could be something like sending us an article that you'd like us to talk about, whether you like the show or not, maybe I need to go away, I don't know, something like that.
No, don't do that, David.
So with that, and of course, the other ways you can help us is you can leave a review on either iTunes or Stitcher. That way other people can find us. You can get some swag at our Cafe Press store or become a patron of the show at patreon.com/theUAVDigest. And of course, all those links are available at our website. So with that, I guess I'll say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.